The following is a presentation of Podjockey.
We're joined now by Stephen Hunter. His latest is Eye Ripper. He's a New York Times bestselling author, most recently of The Third Bullet. And this is basically a different telling of the story of Jack the Ripper. Stephen, thank you for joining us. And I mean, obviously, he's been written about so many times, and it's pretty amazing that these attacks that took place almost 130 years ago over only a three-month period are still the focus of so much attention. Did you think when you started this that, you know, maybe this has already been done by so many different people that I've got to add something totally different and a different approach?
Well, I knew that if I didn't, I would be D-E-A-D. So I struggled to find a different approach. It actually started with a different approach. I had an idea for a possible solution to the Jack mystery. The interesting thing about Jack is after these five gruesome murders, he disappeared. And no one, you know, everyone ever since has been coming up with different theories, some smart, some dumb, some possible, some impossible. It's a great indoor parlor game. And so I came up with a theory that just really took me for a loop, and I thought, God, that would be fun to do. It took me about 5 years to figure out how to tell a story, though. I'm not real smart about this stuff. So I tried a lot of different approaches, and nothing really worked out. Finally, I figured it out. And once I had that, once I had the idea itself and the sort of technical structure by which to express the idea, then it was not a question of not doing it. It was a question. It was suddenly the issue was I had to do it. And the question was, would Simon & Schuster publish it? And fortunately, they agreed to. So here I am, Richard. You've got me.
Okay. Well, I once spoke to an editor, and I had an idea to tell a story from the villain's viewpoint. And he said, oh, no, nobody's going to accept that. You know, they don't want to hear the inner thoughts of a bad guy, and they don't want his justifications, and they don't want you actually to sympathize with that guy as time goes on. And since that conversation, maybe 5 years ago, we've had Mad Men. Of course, Don Draper wasn't a killer, but we've had Tony Soprano, and we've had a lot of so-called villains actually get some sympathy, which I found in reading the diary passages that Jack wrote in your book.
Well, thank you for that. I take that as because I didn't want to present him as a one-dimensional monolith of pure, you know, syrupy evil. He had to be human. He had to have flaws. He had to have the odd grace note. He had to be, you had to feel his presence. He had to have some charm and some amusement value. I guess, again, I don't want to compare myself to because I'm not as good as, but Thomas Harris really is the genius at this stuff. And Hannibal Lecter is a very nasty customer. And yet, he's charming and knowledgeable and charismatic, and in a very peculiar way, we care for him. And while we don't want him to get away with it, at the same time, we don't want him shot by a rookie cop driving by in a bicycle. And I was just trying to work that part of the game, to try and make Jack believable, reprehensible, terrifying, and yet human. I mean, that's pretty hard to do, and I hope and pray and that I did. Readers are going to tell me in the next several weeks whether I did or not, but that was my ideal.
Well, and he also has a social conscience. He calls Queen Victoria Vicky, but he says that she takes every opportunity she can to kill the yellow man or the Indians or anybody that are under her thumb. So he does have a conscience in kind of a strange way.
Yes, that's true, and I enjoyed that aspect of him. And I looked very hard at Victorian society while I was doing this, and I've always loved it. I mean, clearly it's been an interest and obsession of mine. I love the clothes, I love the language, I love the manners, I love the high level of rhetoric and diction. I love the sense of burgeoning or birthing modernism as the world was beginning to recognize certain realities. But at the same time, you understand that there is an ideal and then there is a real. And the real was off times, very ugly, that the whole thing was based on a system of pure exploitation. You understand where the various reformist tendencies, whether you agree with them or not, you certainly understand the passion that generated them. And it's, I felt that, that voice, his social concern, that was not something I planned on. It just happened spontaneously, and it just felt very, very right to me. And I, again, I was, A, little bit surprised by it, and B, at the risk of sounding pompous and self-satisfied, I was actually quite pleased by it. It was a new element in my work, and I thought it worked very well in making Jack decent, or not decent, but human, as opposed to, as I say, the beast from 20,000 fathoms.
Well, and what you also did was you showed us that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Oh, absolutely. And that is totally what this book is about.
That the media, especially, you know, where, oh, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, which, you know, certainly is in effect today with the tabloids. I guess they were broadsheets back then.
You telling the truth, brother. You sing that hymn.
And let's get to the language, because you've captured, I don't know if you've read David Liss at all. You're familiar with his work?
No, the book that I have read that I loved was John Fowle's French Lieutenant's Woman's novel, French Lieutenant's Woman, which of course is a novel in Victorian diction, and that has always stuck in my mind as a brilliant piece of prose. The guy, please give me his name, and I'll look him up and read him.
David Liss is his name, and you've done what he's done, and it sounds so authentic. Now, obviously, we didn't live then, so we don't know, but it just reads like this is what they would write like. You use the vernacular, you have the idiom, you have the expressions that are no longer in use, and it just reads so precisely like what you would imagine a Victorian news writer would write, and also a Victorian villain, for lack of a better word.
Well, thank you, and I really enjoyed that part of it, and I astonished myself. There are several sentences in there that I'm not sure I wrote because I'm not that good. Where did these come from? And you know, it was like I don't think anyone else was in the room with me, but it just sort of seemed to happen. I got to this level where this possibility presented itself, and I let it happen. I let her rip, and what you're reading is was the best I could do at that point in my life.
Did it take you long to find that voice, to be able to sit down and write like that?
It really didn't. It made me think maybe I should have been born in Victorian times. Maybe I'm a natural Victorian. Maybe I wouldn't be so grumpy and cranky if I had been born in Victorian times, because the speed would have been much better for me. But I did seem to have a kind of natural bent towards that level of rhetoric. And see, what I think is so funny is I wrote that book, but 8 or 10 years ago, I wrote a book called Dirty White Boys, which is American hard-boiled rural country, Oklahoma, southern Oklahoma, raw, redneck, kick-ass, 100% road warrior fiction. And the two books, I'm astounded that the same man wrote the two books, because they express such different sensibilities. And I'm astounded, but I'm also very proud. I don't know if I could ever write Dirty White Boys again. I don't know if I could ever write this book again. But I'll tell you this, good, bad, or indifferent, they sure are different.
Well, and yet they capture human nature in that, you know, you have the dirty white boys who obviously have their bigotry and prejudices. And here you've got these Jewish suspects, which had nothing to do with Jack the Ripper. And yet, because of the rampant anti-Semitism, the newspapers, some of them decided to play up the fact that, oh, it could be a Jew that did this.
Yes, that's very true, and it's as I mentioned, the ugliness of that period. That's one of the primary ones. Britain was gripped with xenophobia. There was a huge wave of of immigration, most of it from Eastern Europe, and there was a great deal of anger. And in fact, the police, the Metropolitan Police, in some respects, were more concerned with keeping social order than they were with finding Jack the Ripper. They actually erased one of the clues that he had left, we think he had left, because they were afraid it would stir up riots or pogroms. And, you know, it was probably good social policy, but it was very bad police work.
Well, it's kind of like we have today with the police and, you know, the whole issue with them killing black suspects and,
yeah,
and how
exactly.
Politically they're trying to maneuver that into something. We only have about a minute left, but the gore part of it, you go into graphic description about pulling out intestines and throwing them over his shoulders and everything. Was that hard to write?
Yes, it was. I'm not averse to gore, and having been a professional movie critic, I've seen a lot of it. So it didn't, while it initially put me off, I knew I could do it. The last scene particularly, the Mary Jane Kelly scene, was very hard to write and left me in a funk for a couple of weeks. And I didn't even want to reread it, you know, and I don't think I've reread it since I wrote it. And but on the other hand, Jack was a nasty guy, and I don't want to see him, even if he's human, he shouldn't become an avuncular old Uncle Jack. He was a real monster, and his monstrosity should be documented.
And you did a great job at that. I, Ripper is the book. Stephen Hunter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Richard. You're very good.
The proceeding is a presentation of Podjockey. Copyright 2015. All rights reserved.